Well, good morning again. It really is good to be back. We had a good time. I particularly like going up there to Missy's folks' place because as a kid, I always wanted to be where, you know, they like picked kids to get to play computers in school when I was in elementary school. And you really, you had to do your work. You had to be quiet. They had some criteria that I didn't ever meet very often. But I loved getting to play the Oregon Trail game. And it's always one of my jokes around the house. Anytime I see something about dysentery on that game, I never lived very long. I never made it to Chimney Rock. I always got dysentery. So right up there where Missy's from, I married a girl in the shadow, from the shadow of Chimney Rock, a place I never got on the video game. But real life, it turns out I did better at that. But anyway, we're right there at the beginning of the Oregon Trail, and we're up upon a monument there looking out. And I said, boy, this looks like a great place to get dysentery. Unlike all of you, nobody, they've heard that so many times, nobody even listened to me. So I tried saying it 3 or 4 more times, and finally a stranger just kind of smiled and nodded at me. But I do enjoy going up there. I enjoy history, that kind of stuff. So even though nobody else enjoys it as much as I do. Well, this morning we're going to talk about substitutes. I guess there was no substitute for the Oregon Trail, so that was just a story to tell a story. But a lot of times when we go to Walmart, especially me, if there's a generic version of what's out there, that's probably what I'm going to buy. Charmin is the exception. I don't go cheap on toilet paper. But if we go to the pharmacy, we always ask for that generic version of the medicine the doctor prescribed, or we'll buy whatever the generic version that Kellogg's or Land O'Lakes puts out there on the shelves. And we don't feel bad because at times when accepting substitutes seems to make sense to us. Sometimes there's almost no difference at all between the name brand and the substitutes, but of course, that's not always true. Centuries ago, when food production moved from the house to the factory, and the pressures of large-scale manufacturing and marketing prompted merchants to begin resorting to shortcuts. Cash-hungry bakers to get more dough for their dough by adding alum or sulfur of copper. Dairymen would sell thickened cream with flour, watered-down milk, and often would add chalk or plaster of Paris to perk up the color of milk that came from diseased cows. To stretch sugar a little bit further, oftentimes sand was added. Buying butter could be a real exercise in futility. Merchants would sometimes put together a collection of calcium and gypsum and gelatin fat and mashed potatoes that they passed off as butter. But maybe oleomargarine, which was known as bogus butter, could be even worse. There, it was distilled from hog fat, bleach, and other unsavory substances. One of the most blatant cases of food adulteration occurred as recently as 1969, when a man in England was charged with selling phony grated Parmesan cheese. And I was almost relieved when I read that he was using ground-up umbrella handles. I don't know where your minds went, but mine went to a lot worse place. So I was almost happy with umbrella handles. But there are times when substitutes can be as good as the original, and then sometimes not so much. The Israelites had gotten into the habit of accepting substitutes for God. In Jeremiah 2:11, there it complains, "Has a nation changed its gods, even though they are no gods? But my people have changed their glory for that which does not profit." Israel had accepted substitutes for their God. The verse that really caught my attention in the text this morning is there in verse 13 of Jeremiah 2, where it's recorded as, "For my people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters, and hewed out cisterns for themselves, broken cisterns that can hold no water." It's sort of the comparison of an artesian well and a cistern. And that artesian well is that source of water that literally shoots up out of the ground without any need for pumps or any artificial assistance. It is literally living water. It's that place on hot summer days that you can cup your hands under the stream and splash water over your head. You could put your whole head underneath and feel the freshness cool your body. And you'll always hear about the taste. There is nothing that tastes better than water that comes fresh from a spring. And then cisterns, on the other hand, that is usually just a hole in the ground, an underground tank that is designed to hold water. Unlike water from the well, this is soft water. I don't think anybody, I'm sure they have, but they don't want to drink water from the cistern. That water is usually stagnant and not exactly appealing on a hot summer day. But it's useful. Cisterns were very useful in the Middle East. Springs were not always abundant, and so people would dig wells and cisterns to catch rainwater and hold whatever water that they might be able to carry from other sources to be their source of drinking water for their family and herds and flocks. But when push came to shove, any man in his right mind wanted living water and not water from the cistern. Oddly enough, here in Jeremiah 2, we find that God is accusing Israel of preferring the stagnant waters of a cistern to the cool, refreshing, living water that God wanted to supply them with. Well, why would the Israelites do that? Why would they prefer stagnant water to fresh? Well, I believe the key to that is found right there in verse 13, where it says, the NIV says they have dug their own cisterns. The ESV says they have hewed out cisterns for themselves. No matter how you read that, it was their cisterns. They owned them. It was their water. They didn't have to ask anyone, let alone God, for permission to use this water. But to get God's water, there was a price. Isaiah 55, 1 and 2 says, "Come, everyone who thirsts, come to the waters. He who has no money, come, buy and eat. Come, buy wine and milk without money and without price. Why do you spend your money for that which is not bread, and your labor for that which does not satisfy? Listen diligently to me and eat what is good, and delight yourselves in rich food." Well, wait a minute. If this water doesn't cost any money, how do you go about buying it? Well, you have to come to the waters, and you have to listen to God. Jesus would say pretty much the same thing in John chapter 7, beginning in verse 37, where it tells us that Jesus stood up during a feast in a loud voice. He said, "If anyone thirsts, let him come to me and drink. Whoever believes in me, as the scripture has said, out of his heart will flow rivers of living water." And that, of course, is the catch. In order to get God's kind of water, first you have to come to God. And then you have to listen to what Jesus has to say. And you have to accept his standard and live according to his desires. Some people have a difficult time living by anybody's standards, let alone God's. And this is kind of going off into the weeds, but about 20 years ago, there was an article in Time magazine, and it was an article about Superman. And at that time, the superhero had fallen on some hard times. And even though a cartoon character, he is, of course, the icon of DC Comics, was trailing very far behind with Batman in popularity. At DC Comics, Jim Lee had been the popular illustrator for Batman. He was tapped to begin to take over the art on Superman. And he said that he looked at this as a very serious challenge. And these are Lee's words. He says, "Batman is a more modern era type character. Batman is fueled by vengeance. He's the boogeyman. Superman is the altruistic alien hero that protects us all. It's difficult to make that believable in this day and age." And then at the end of the article, these are some of the final words. Lee said, "Superman is a metaphor for America, but an outdated, obsolete America. Invulnerable to attack, always on the side of right, always ready to save the rest of the world from its villainy, whether it wants to be saved or not. In the past, every decade has got the Superman it deserves. And don't worry, we'll get ours, but he will probably be flawed, more man than super. And then the very last words were these: Americans don't want to be told what to aspire to anymore, who we should be. Well, I don't know if all of that is true or not. I don't know if all Americans don't want to be told who to aspire to anymore or what they should be. But certainly this author had known people that were like that. And God knew people like that too. In this case, they were called Israelites. Israel had gotten to the point where they didn't want God or anyone else to tell them how they should live their lives or what they should aspire to be. They wanted to dig their own wells. They wanted to drink their own water. And it's not that they didn't want God. They just didn't want this God. They didn't want his rules, his regulations, his expectations in their lives. So how did the Israelites get to being like this? I don't think they just woke up one morning and said, I don't want to serve God anymore. These were very religious people. According to verse 8 there of Jeremiah 2, these people still had priests, and they had prophets, and they had those who dealt with the law. The problem was not that Israel had stopped being religious. They had simply just gotten into the habit of creating God in their own image. They wanted gods. They wanted gods that would allow them to dig their own wells. They wanted gods that would mold them, or they would mold their gods into their own lifestyles. Gods who would morph into what they wanted them to be. At times, substituting for God isn't a matter of openly rejecting God. Sometimes it's just a simple matter of compromising our faith so that the God we claim we love really doesn't resemble that God who died for us. During the first Gulf War, Ann Landers asked citizens to send letters of encouragement to the soldiers. And she asked that the letters be addressed to any service member, Operation Desert Storm, APO New York, and put Operation Dear Abby on the return address. In that, there was some organizations within the religious community that decided to send some tracts as well as some letters preaching Christianity. Well, this, of course, didn't sit very well with the Arabs, who, though were very glad to have Americans maybe shed their blood to defend them, they didn't want and they wouldn't allow them to share their faith. American soldiers were told not to even wear a cross on their uniform. And so General Schwarzkopf called the military chaplains in, and one with the rank of colonel ordered him to call the organizer and confront him about what he was doing. And the chaplain told the organizer this. He said, "We as chaplains are not here to evangelize. We're here to provide spiritual needs of our men and women in uniform. Our responsibility is to them only. Period. Is that understood?" And the writer replied, "Colonel, I appreciate that. Everyone in this country is backing and supporting our men and women in uniform. We're proud of you. But I'm going to be honest with you, sir. The religious unfairness has upset me and others in America. Our men and women are being asked to put their lives on the line, possibly to spill blood to protect the oil there. And you, a chaplain, can't even wear your cross in public. The Saudis want our blood, but not what we believe in." And the colonel finally replied. He said, "I understand what you are trying to do. I'm a Christian as well, but I'm under orders." And the writer interrupted with these words. He said, "So am I. Orders from the King of Kings to go into all the world and preach the gospel and make disciples of every nation." Well, that chaplain was confronted by a very uncomfortable reality. Without realizing what had happened to him, he had begun to dig his own wells. He had allowed God to be molded by his job. The God that he thought he loved had morphed into a God that wouldn't offend anyone. He had accepted a substitute. And we have to always be on guard that we don't fall into that same trap. We have to be careful not to compromise our faith. we must be careful to avoid accepting substitutes for our God. So how do we do that? Well, this is going to seem a bit simplistic, but I believe the answer is just to accept no substitutes, to seek God, to seek His will, and to humble yourself under His authority. God condemned the priests of Jeremiah's day because the priests did not ask, "Where is the Lord?" The priests never bothered to seek God, or His will, or anything else that God wanted. But God promises in Deuteronomy 4:29 that from there you will seek the Lord your God and you will find Him if you search after Him with all of your heart and with all of your soul. God isn't talking about a half-hearted, going through the motions type of seeking. We are to look for Him with all of our hearts and all of our souls. David recognized this when he wrote in Psalm 63, verse 1, "O God, you are my God. Earnestly I seek you. My soul thirsts for you. My flesh faints for you as in a dry and weary land where there is no water." What David was saying was, there is no substitutes. He was crying out that there was nothing else that would satisfy. Nothing else that would be acceptable. David literally felt that he would die of thirst if he accepted anything than what God could supply. Well, in closing, Tertullian was a theologian who lived in Carthage around 200 AD. And one man came to him asking him how he could be both a faithful Christian and a success in business. Of course, at the time, Christianity was being publicly ridiculed and scorned by many, and frequently was persecuted by the government. The man knew that he was supposed to be completely loyal to Christ, but he wondered if maybe compromise might be permitted. Couldn't he carry commitment to both his faith and his business? He feared his church membership might ruin him financially. And he exclaimed, "What can I do? I must live." Then Tertullian gave a pretty harsh reply. His reply was, "Must you? Must you live?" And I guess the hard answer to that is no, you don't have to. Because as Christians, we do have a promise that is so much better than this life. Why would we want to settle for a stale and stagnant life that rarely tastes good, that simply gets by when we could have a God and all that life was meant to be? All through Scripture, we are told of stories of men and women who were faced with temptation to compromise, faced with a potential loss, not only of their possessions, but most of the time of their very lives. The great ones chose God, and God was always faithful. Don't compromise. Don't accept substitutes. Don't